Hi, listeners. This week, because of our friends at Blue Apron, we can bring you this show. So help your favorite podcast, including this one, stay free to download. Complete a short anonymous survey that takes no more than 5 minutes. I'm asking you to go to podcast.study to complete the survey. You can do all of us at the 45th a huge favor by filling it out. Thanks so much, and here's the show.
There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
Right now, a historic moment. We can now project the winner of the presidential race.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
The president-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
Donald J. Trump is the president of the United States elect.
This is a political upset of huge, huge magnitude.
Your country still divided.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th podcast. I'm Rabia Chaudhry, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Susan Simpson and Sara Basha.
Hi.
Hey, it's good to be back for our second episode. Although we're currently thinking about possibly moving to a weekly format just because in Trump time, 2 weeks is basically like what? A quarter of a regular administration?
You could write like volumes about the last 2 weeks, I think.
They will at some point.
50 executive orders.
Yeah, we are thinking about that. And we've gotten so many tweets and so many comments about why don't you guys go to weekly? It's just too long of a gap. Part of it, as some of my listeners know, is I did have a baby a week ago, literally. So I need a little bit of time just to get on my legs again. But I think all of us are kind of moving in that direction of bringing you a weekly show soon.
Yeah, seriously, Rabia is a rock star. And I don't know how she's doing this, but, you know, keep it up, Rabia.
I'm on the 45th because of the babies. I've got babies to think about. They got to live in this country. But how have you guys been? How's your last couple weeks been? What about the feedback to our first episode?
I am not a Twitter user, so...
You're going to have to change that.
Well, I'm not used to it. So getting tweets daily was kind of a new thing. I really added to the pile of stuff that gives me ADD. So,
Wait, do you have the Twitter app on your phone? Because you got to start there.
Yes, of course I do.
Okay.
All right.
What about you, Susan? How have you been?
Not too bad. We're still here. The country's still more or less like functioning. So that's a win.
More or less alarmed than 2 weeks ago? That's the question.
I don't think my alarm level's really changed in the past, like, 2 months.
Okay.
It's been a constant, like, steady, this is bad.
No apathy setting in?
No. I mean, everyone keeps talking about how, or kept talking about how there's going to be, like, you know, outrage fatigue or, like, you know, people would, like, get tired out. I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, just because it keeps on going doesn't mean the threat's going away, and people recognize that.
And I don't think the media is going to let it happen. I mean, this is a constant feeding frenzy for the media. The stories just don't stop. But we all have a lot of stuff on our minds. So let's get right into it. And we're going to start off this week with Sara telling us what are the things you have been following in the news the last couple weeks.
Okay, but I have a disclaimer before we start.
Sure.
So I've got some questions about my accent. So I just wanted to clarify real quick. I have this really talented ability. It's called dialectic modification. So what it is I grew up with a very British accent as a kid, moved to the U.S. about 20-odd years ago, more than 20-something years ago. And so sometimes I slip into my old accent. Sometimes I kind of morph it and I sound Australian. And sometimes I can sound like I'm very confused. So I just want to let the listeners know that when they listen to me, don't focus on trying to figure out where I'm from. Just try to figure out on the content.
Maybe people think you're like Madonna, where like she confused everybody by adopting a new accent.
Well, along with the dialect modification, I guess I do something called code switching because I speak 3 languages, so I can switch between languages as well.
What languages do you speak?
I speak Urdu/Hindi. I speak a little bit Arabic. I speak, obviously, English. So, yeah, I think it's a fun talent to have. So not been a problem.
It's a good skill to have. But at the end of the day, I wonder if the concern from speakers is she an American? Are they demanding birth certificates? Is that what we're...
I don't think it was those type of people, but that's okay.
Okay.
But anyway, so the thing that's been on my mind, and I know you talked about, Susan just mentioned, you know, she's still feeling alarmed, but I'm feeling kind of hopeful about the system working for us and our government system, because I'm seeing the checks and balances. And some days I don't see it. Other days I'm like, yay, look, it came through for us. The biggest thing that stuck out to me in the last 2 weeks that we've been on hiatus is the joint address before Congress. So I don't know if it's because I live in a cosmopolitan area that I just don't see that sweeping optimism. But I mean, what do you guys think? Is it just because we're exposed to kind of leftist media all the time, so it doesn't seem so great? Or is it seriously, are people actually feeling okay across the country?
I see optimism among, well, I don't know how long it's going to last, but optimism among Republican lawmakers who thought they were going to get a chance to, or still think that you're going to get a chance to, you know, carry out an agenda they've wanted to carry out for a decade and really couldn't.
Well, see, and that's what I think you bring up a great point, because I think that's what that joint address was obviously about, getting through to them and giving them what they want. So, you know, I just briefly to go through some of the main things. Hey, Rabia, real quick, were you interested in the fact that he actually named it radical Islamic terrorism?
Yeah, I mean, I know, look, this, he has been campaigning on this, that I'm going to call it out for what it is. I'm going to name it, like, that will magically make all the terrorists just, I don't know, dissolve like salt and water. In terms of like the optimism thing that you mentioned, I just really think with this administration, like, literally the streets could be on actual fire outside their doors, and they will still say, no, everything's going great. You know, we are doing fantastic things. Of course he's going to say that. What's he going to say? That half the country is like in a deep depression and is terrified. We're all going to die. He's not going to say that. So,
well, I saw it as a very classic kind of conservative speech. And very first thought I had was, who wrote that? Because I thought, and I think I posted this somewhere, I was like, I think Paul Ryan wrote a great speech. But honestly, I think that, you know, the fact that those terms are being used doesn't bother me as much, because at the end of the day, I don't see it as like a problem that's going to linger for too much longer. But what I got alarmed at is the lack of perspective in the statement that came with it, attached to it, which is the sighting of Boston and San Bernardino and World Trade. I'm like, we know all of those things happened. But to say that the DOJ data shows that the vast majority of terror in the country is coming from outside, that's just not correct. And, you know, for me, that's skewing the perspective of people, to convince people that this is a really, really scary time. And that's been the main, I guess, mantra of this administration. But using that terminology as well just doesn't help in my view. But more than terminology, maybe it's a perspective part of it. So I also felt like nothing went down in terms of the rhetoric against immigration. I mean, the speech also kind of made it look like immigrants are just bringing no skills to the country, and they're just coming here and sucking up welfare and taking our jobs away. And I've actually spoken to people that feel this way. So it does touch on popular sentiment to some degree. But again, does that really have perspective, that kind of view? I mean, to keep thinking that immigrants are going to just suck the money out of the country and take away our jobs and threaten us that way, and we need to start bringing in more skilled labor so that they kind of assimilate with the middle class right away. I mean, that's the majority of people that are coming into this country. So that struck me.
It almost sounds like, Sarah, that you're evaluating his speech as if this was the old times still. I mean, it's as if it was, and maybe that's one way to do it, but all those factual problems you're pointing out were just throughout the entire speech. Like there was no concern for the truth in anything he said. So trying to evaluate the factual like accuracy of what he was saying almost feels like a fool's errand to me.
But see, there's another side to this, which is if they're going to deal with terrorism, increasing support for military, I think, is a great thing. And I think he has been trying to follow through on that. If you've seen the offensives in Mosul and some in Syria, now we've got more troops on the ground, and it's actually gotten to a point where I guess Assad is speaking up against us and saying, he doesn't really appreciate U.S. forces operating at a local level in Syria. To me, that says we're getting stuff done. So that angle of it, you know, if you're going to put soldiers in the line of fire, you might as well, you have to equip them with what they need, right? So I think that's one thing the military is getting out of this president. So on one side, that aspect of handling radical Islamic terrorism has been working. But I think this whole fear-mongering for immigrants and stuff is just lacking in perspective, so...
But wait a minute, what is the connection between increasing our troop presence overseas to fighting radical Islamic terrorism here in the United States? I mean, it's a completely different phenomenon.
No, it's not. It's connected because it's all about ISIS, right? It's the radical Islamic terrorists are an offshoot of ISIS, and this is how we're going to take care of ISIS abroad with the military, and this is how we're going to take care of it locally, by just shutting off the borders or vetting people to the point where...
But what we know about most ISIS-inspired terrorism is that there is rarely direct connection. I mean, these people just say, I pledge to ISIS. It's an ideology, and that's... I think we need to also have the conversation about whether an increased troop presence actually is going to eliminate ISIS. I don't think it's going to happen at all. But you certainly cannot use troops and combat to fight, you know, an ideology that somebody in the United States or any part of the world is like, you know, I'm just inspired by these ideas. You can wipe out these people. You can kill like 3,000 ISIS soldiers, but I'm still over here in Denmark somewhere or in Arkansas somewhere, angry about this, radicalized about this, and I'm going to do something, and I'm totally alone. I'm a lone wolf. I mean, there's no way to fight that, militarily.
Yeah, but you're assuming that it's just the ideology. I think it's geopolitics for the Middle East, really. And I think us being on the ground has a lot more to do with which factions are going to take over which area and how the landscape's going to be, more than the spread of ISIS so much. I mean, our presence on the ground has more than just the, you know.
But our presence, don't you think? So let me ask you, don't you think our presence on the ground in the last decade plus has been what has transformed? I mean, ISIS didn't exist before, right? I mean, it has transformed smaller pockets of these violent radical terrorists into something much more organized. ISIS is much more savvy, organized, and successful than like Al-Qaeda was, Al-Shabaab, all these other organizations. I think they have kind of been a product of our presence and continued military aggression. Like, that has been the response of these groups to coalesce into something more powerful.
Well,
and I think they could morph again. I think they could just morph again, because that's the problem. We're not dealing with...
If it's not ISIS, it'll be in something else.
I'm not denying that you have to deal with the ideology, but I think that's more of an internal Muslim discussion. My thing is here, we're actually doing supportive roles with the military more than offensives on our own. I mean, because let's face it, we don't understand that landscape at all, and we need local people to help us with that. The question is, you know, how do we build our alliances and figure out which local people to support? And I think we are trying to do that now. And I think the fact that Assad's saying something means he's getting a little nervous about the type of influence we have on the ground, which means we're doing stuff. And
travel ban, though, undermined anything he could possibly be hoping to do in that direction, because we've now effectively told anyone local, don't help us, don't expect us to help you later if you do.
Well, there's been a little bit of a change in the travel ban. I'll talk about that, because they took Iraq off the list, and they worked in many, many exceptions and waivers and stuff like that. So that might be their way to combat that. But
I guess for me, the ultimate problem for all of this is that the basic problem that he claims he's trying to address is based on false claims. And how can you evaluate any plan to fix something that's not factually true in the first place?
I don't even think it's false claims. I think it's sometimes a little piece of a fact that's taken and blown out of proportion. So it's a perspective issue. And a lot of times that's what I feel it is. It's taking something that's...
You're so generous.
You know, I'm trying to put myself in the place of a person who's leading the country, and all these ugly secrets come out, and you're kind of like, how do I solve this? And you know what, the media perceptions are really totally off on this. So I'm trying to give that leeway here. But I did see in that whole speech, it was a classic Republican speech, and it was beautiful. It was great. It was done well. It was written well, and he delivered it pretty well. The question is, not only is the perspective a little off, but I didn't see any ways that there were concrete actions that, you know, reflected that this stuff is going to be easy to do or is already happening.
Or they even plan to do it. He didn't give any specifics whatsoever. He just says, here's some things that may, like, here's a problem, whether it is or is not, and then says, we're going to fix it, and then goes to the next thing.
Well, that's been the last year, 18 months with him.
Yeah. I mean,
that's his time,
Of all the lines that I heard in the speech, the one that was just literally a one-liner was on education. It's just, it was basically, education is a civil rights issue of our time. And then talk of allowing African-American Latino children to actually have school choice. And then that was it.
I mean,
what did you think about that? Do you think education is civil rights?
Well,
it caused a little bit of a furor on Twitter. I know that.
Well, listen, as a conservative, I do, you know, I do feel, and a mother of four, and I put my kids through public and private schools. I do feel like I want to have that choice. I want to be able to pick and choose. And I do feel like one system, you know, puts the onus on teachers and administrators to provide better quality education. But as a conservative, I do want more local control of what my kids are going to learn, how they learn it, how much I pay for it, all that good stuff. But at the same time, there's something to be said for having a general standard by which to measure how people are doing. And honestly, I think I'm going to say this. I think that a lot of problems with wages and job loss in this country have to do with our lack of skilled labor. And we keep maligning immigrants. We kind of need them in some ways because they up the competition as well in our schools and everywhere else. But we also don't realize that, you know, when it comes to having choices, we need to be able to have a better standard, too, because our kids come out of school and they have less of the skills that are needed for those jobs than kids coming from outside from other systems. And I've seen that firsthand. I mean, I've been watching that as a mother. So to some degree, I feel like our education system's quality needs to be addressed, especially at the elementary level, high school, because then you come out of elementary, high school, and you're competing with kids in college who have been to fantastic systems in different countries. And it's hard to get the jobs that they could vie for very easily. So this whole thing of fear of immigrants, I just think it's been blown out of proportion. It's just unfair. But I think focusing on the education system is what we need to be doing. And yet that's the line we got. And then just judging by who's in charge of that and what's being done, I don't hear very much about how all this stuff of, you know, changing our system into public, private, charter, magnet, religious or homeschooling. I mean, those already exist. It's like, to what degree is that going to be changing?
Well, I thought, I think for me, the framing of it as, I mean, like, aside from the substance of the conversation itself on education, the framing of it as a civil rights issue of our time was, I was kind of gobsmacked, because I can tell you the Black Lives Matter would say, no, that's not the civil rights issue. It's a part of the civil rights issue. Obviously, like, access to education, good education, is part and parcel of civil rights. But there, I mean, but that is, to me, like, a big smack in the face of so many civil rights activists and other people who are like, are focusing on many other systematic injustices like police brutality and mass incarceration and other kinds of like civil rights issues that I'm thinking.
Yeah.
I thought that was a deliberate rejection of those things. Right. I thought that was on purpose to say, hey, yeah, sure, we're interested in civil rights, but not the kind that you're talking about, like, because, you know, those are not important.
We want the civil right to teach our children creationism.
Yeah.
Well, I actually subliminally translated that to mean that all our civil rights issues will be solved, or the majority of them, if we just improve the education system and give the same opportunity to Blacks and Latinos. That's how I thought.
I'm just like quietly processing.
I know.
Thinking about that. What do you think about that, Susan?
I actually think that I think that might have been a message they were trying to send that I did not catch on until Sarah said it. And I think she's right that's something they're trying to. There's a subtle sort of like victim blaming to it, I think, and how they, if that framing's right, which it makes sense to me. Like, they're trying to say, oh, look, if we just make people better, they'll be able to solve the problems themselves. And we fix the education system and they can fix themselves and all good to go.
No, as in they can get better jobs. It can be, you know, equal participants in the workforce and we won't have these issues.
And the government doesn't have to do anything. It's just to improve education and everyone's responsible for their own stuff after that.
Yeah, it's a real simple fix too. I'm very, very difficult multi-layered
socio-historic
economic problem. I mean, it's not enough.
Hey, but listen, since we're on the topic of education and jobs, I wanted to say that that's also another area where jobs are being promised through major corporations, and also, you know, this whole thing about the federal hiring freeze, but not a military personnel, and the fact that we drain the swamp. I mean, if you're going to talk about hiring and stuff, where are the cabinet positions that are still lying open?
Bannon's stated goal is to destroy the Ministry of State, so not hiring people is part and parcel of that.
But can I tell you, it's so hard to do outreach to the White House or anywhere if there's not enough people to reach out to.
That's the point. That's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah, I think that's deliberate. I don't think that's by mistake. I think they want to be they don't want a lot of access.
I don't know if it's that. It could also be a combination of people just not wanting to be in those positions. So
that probably is part of it, too. But they're trying to make things entirely different and much more insular, much more out of the normal channels of communication. Like, that's why they're shutting down the State Department, essentially. And they've told all the foreign affairs from other countries, contact Kushner, not the State Department.
Yeah, but listen, if jobs and job creation was the core of what got the president his support across America, then where is the outline of how these jobs are going to happen? Like, how is he explaining how technology is going to lessen or increase the workforce? I mean, just creating these jobs is going to be fine, but do you realize that these jobs are, like I said last time, heavily mechanized, as computerization? There's a bunch of stuff where not as much labor is needed, and that's promised to coal miners and stuff. I just don't see things happening, and if they are happening, I don't see where the breakdown of how they're going to happen.
His entire goal is to get good coverage about that by having, like, you know, new jobs and new factories that are planned since 2013 to be announced as his creation. So he gets the headlines he wants. The news cycle's like, Trump announces that Carrier has a bunch of jobs that he brought to the country. And he wants that perception to control his ratings in that area.
Yeah, but these jobs are like 10,000 jobs here, 10,000 jobs there. I mean, is that like a massive systemic, economic boost for us? Or is it these little pockets of people being hired?
I don't think he cares about that.
I thought the briefing where Spicer, you know, gleefully announced 234,000 new jobs in the month of February, which has kind of been consistent with the past five Februaries. But anyhow, that these were the makings of Trump, doings of Trump. But, you know, in the past, Trump himself said that these job reports showing Obama is increasing jobs and reducing unemployment are fake. And his response this time was that, well, those might have been fake, but this time it's real.
Our president doesn't believe in facts and figures, thinks he can control what is true and what is not. That's hilarious.
But, you know, but Sara, because like I said, you know, I said earlier that you're being generous. And I don't think you're being generous. Like, I think you are seeing a lot of things coming out of this administration through a different lens. I'm definitely a skeptic. I just have a really negative view of everything that's happening. So how do you interpret a comment like that? It might have been they were fake in the past, but it's real now. Like, what is your generous take on that?
For what? Fake in the past?
The jobs numbers.
The job numbers. I mean, like, yeah.
I don't know what to say about that. All I know is that from a conservative standpoint, he's hitting on all the right things. So if you're looking at it in terms of the concepts, yeah, he's telling people what they want to hear. But that's what I'm saying. My fear is, can you really do this? Where's the evidence? I mean,
well, no, not in terms of the jobs itself, but in terms of how they're like treating our factual reality. As in, you can only believe like factual numbers when they support what we say. Otherwise, they're false. That message seems so inherently damaging to our administrative state that I don't know how. I get why people laugh, because it's at this point, this point's also a punchline because that's how we're going as a country. But I don't get how people who are part of this administration and not part of Bannon's "let's destroy everything" state are rationalizing that, because there's something so inherently problematic with a president who says that only facts that support him can be believed.
Right. So if you have new jobs numbers in the next few months that show like a tremendous loss of jobs or a gain, you know, increase in unemployment, I think the administration will dismiss it as saying that these reports are wrong. They're just either it's fake, it's done on purpose by the media, or they're just outright wrong. And they'll look for other their own statistics, like from Breitbart or something.
You know, putting out these numbers and wondering where they come from and how legitimate they can be seen as. It's about being media literate. Our country's struggling with that, by the way. We're not very media literate. We don't know how to look at a piece of media and figure out what the source is, who put it out there, what their agenda might be, whether it's even doctored physically in terms of Photoshop and stuff. We're not able to look at stuff like that. There are a handful of media outlets in this country, not handful, but quite a most, the majority are decent and you can rely on them as being, you know, solid. But then people don't know how to read. They don't know the difference between infotainment and actual news sometimes. And that's really frustrating because this is how this happens, is when you blur that line even more. So
no,
I would.
Sarah, this is not about like, this is the same source of news, the jobs numbers. You have during the whole campaign, Trump is saying it's fake, it's a lie, it's untrue, it's all like political and fraudulent. And now he's in office, it's a good report, and he's going to claim somehow responsibility for it. And he's like, yeah, now we can believe it.
Like, I'm not denying that at all. I just think that eventually the numbers speak for themselves, and then the checks and balances come in, and the person that's not accurate shows up. It's going to come with time. I just think
his voters believed him when he said they weren't true, when it was the same source, the same exact, if it was true now, it was true then. And his voters believed him when he said back then it wasn't true. So they're not believing a source. They're believing what Trump says.
Well, that's what I talked about, media literacy, being able to understand where is this coming from, who's putting it out there, how are they trying to skew my view or influence my mind.
My question would be, to the extent that the Republican establishment is getting behind this only Trump is the source of truth narrative, which they are, how do you evaluate that as conservative and how you stand with their whole...
I don't think they all do. Honestly, I think it's what Rob
said. They're staying silent, too. I think also, I think the silence allows it to happen, too. There's not a lot of, no, we don't really agree there. It's just kind of...
Okay, wait.
Nobody's saying anything.
So you guys are both lawyers, right? So what is one thing that you have to let happen in the courtroom? Due process, right? So in some ways, I see this whole elapsing time as a process where our system has to work itself out and, you know, the checks and balances. I actually put my full faith in them. And I'm just, to me, I'm not afraid of personalities because I feel the checks and balances will either put them where they need to be eventually. But these things take time. So I think it's all so fresh and so new. And what you're saying has legitimacy, and let things play out how they have to. I do think there's huge voices in the Republican arena that are speaking up on so many levels. And some of the ones that I've been listening to a lot are McCain and Lindsey Graham at this point. I mean, they've been pretty vocal.
They're the only two, though. I mean, predominantly the two. I guess checks and balances aren't real things. They're just part of people's behavioral patterns. And right now, those patterns don't seem to be present in a lot of cases. And I'm not sure what will be left to be the check or balance if this the way things are going now.
Well, I still have faith in the fact that the justice system has helped with the executive orders and stuff like that. I think that's a prime example of how it's worked so far. I'm just saying on a larger scale, I think those checks and balances and the truth, I'm happy to say, in this country that we live in, prevails at some point or largely anywhere else.
Here's what I'll push back against you. I think that you can't wait till a later day to start the checks and balances. They have to start now. If we're not going to speak out against the president's malicious use of truth and falsehood to his own ends, now, when do we start speaking out against it? Like, you can't, if it's not now, when?
GOP leadership, I would be planning if I was in the GOP leadership, I would be planning for a Pence presidency and just saying, how do we get rid of this guy? Because he's damaging Democratic institutions. He's damaging other things that should serve the GOP. And I think we'll end up actually hurting the GOP. I mean, I think in 2018, it's going to hurt them. I think down the road, it's going to hurt them. I think they'd be better served to protect, but I don't know. I mean,
I don't think so, guys. I think that's very...
They can't.
It's very apocalyptic, that kind of view. I think there's some good legislation that's probably happening behind the scenes, smaller stuff that we don't get. And I can give an example. We've had bills going through to help women in certain fields, like STEM research and STEM, increasing the STEM access for girls and women. We've had stuff like that happening on a daily basis. True, the bigger things are still the bigger problems. But I think the thing here is the the president doesn't control everything. He's just one of the three branches, right? That's just the executive branch. There's still the legislative, still the judiciary. We still have that system of checks and balances. And yeah, I mean, it's going to take time. It's not going to happen overnight. Now, think about it this way. If everybody just dismissed the guy within like 6 weeks and says, whoop, you know, we got to get rid of him, don't you think people would have an uproar and say, wait a minute, you didn't even give him a chance, right? So
yeah, no, I they're not going to get rid of him now, because they would rightfully get their butts handed to them in primaries if they tried to oust him now. And they'd be giant hypocrites, because for everyone who supported him, if he was that terrible, why'd you support him then? So they're forced to, you know, whether they believe it personally or not, they're forced to maintain an appearance that they didn't endorse someone they personally find repugnant.
Honestly, I think either to survive, he's either going to have to change his demeanor a bit, or his out, you know, the way he does stuff, or it's just going to be something major that's going to happen.
But, well, you know, it's for the last week, he's been kind of quiet. I thought what was really interesting, and he gave this joint address, right? He had a great, I think, 24 hours. Things started unraveling, and then came that tweet about Obama being behind wiretapping Trump Towers. Incredible charge, incredible allegation from the current president to the former president. And since that time, he's been like, I feel like he's been really quiet. First of all, can we talk about that tweet?
And this goes back again to the fact that if we don't push back now, when? I mean, this is a huge charge. This is a like nation-shaking, history-making charge that he's making. And a lot of some Republicans, to their credit, have like kind of trolled him back, like, well, that sounds very serious. Let's investigate it right away. But some of them just were like, let's pretend he didn't say it. That's really super awkward.
But guys, this knee-jerk type of reactions haven't been anything new. So,
but that's like the fact that it's not new doesn't mean it's not insanely dangerous. Like, this is not acceptable in a democracy to have a president who makes very serious criminal charges without any evidence whatsoever.
This is different. Especially this is not Apprentice. Opponent. This is not Schwarzenegger. Yeah. This is not Nordstrom. This is different on a whole nother scale, I feel like. So it's not the regular crazy. It is amped up.
Yeah, no, sorry. Okay, sorry. The current sitting president is making unfounded, baseless accusations of very serious criminal conduct against a political enemy, and throwing it out there for the whole world to see, refusing to give any evidence to support it, and then just doubles down on it being true, again, without any evidence. Doesn't that sound really scary to you?
Not disagreeing with you at all. It's just, you know, I feel like it's part of the whole way he functions, so I don't see why you're that surprised.
It's not surprising. It's more that the fact that checks and balances aren't coming into play to react the way they should against such a terrible situation.
Well, again, I think you need to give it time.
And look, we have... And I've got a clip right here.
You know, there are one of two possibilities here. Either the president quite deliberately for some reason made up this charge, or perhaps more disturbing, the president really believes this. And here's where I think it's consequential, George. If 6 months from now the president should say that Iran is cheating on the nuclear agreement, if he's making that up, it's a real problem. If he's not making up and it's true, it's an even bigger problem, because the question is, would people believe him? Would American people believe him? Would people around the world believe him? And that has real world consequences.
You know, there's only a couple of options here. Like, you know, either the president is completely fabricating these allegations, like out of nowhere. Okay. And he knows they're lies. Now that has its own serious implications, right? Or he actually believes it. And I can't decide which one to me is scarier. Because if he actually believes this, then what is his source? Which, again, you know, his surrogates have been asked repeatedly, can you tell us the source? Can you tell us the source of this information? And they have just completely bounced those by saying, well, we should investigate and find out. I mean, that's not how this should work. Like, the person making the allegation should provide the evidence, at least, you know, at least a source. And then from there, you decide whether there's enough to even go forward with an investigation. But I can't decide which it is. If he's just making it up, if it's something that he thinks will distract from other stories and other investigations surrounding him and his staffers, to distract the American public, or he actually heard it, like on some weird, you know,
he believes it. He heard it. Well, it was Breitbart.
There's two things here. First of all, you don't make an allegation without knowing 1,000%. whether it's true and what the ramifications are of actually disclosing it, right? The second part is, it's a classical example of when a leader surrounds himself with people that just, you know, have a certain set of views, and he continues to function in that environment, he's not going to be able to think very rationally about the consequences of things. Because, I mean, if you look back in history at all, and I hate to use this word, dictators, they surrounded themselves with their cronies and heard what they wanted to hear. And even if it sounded outrageous to the population, it is what he was thinking. And they literally think that it has credibility because that's their world. That's what they think is the truth. So
that's our world now.
We're going to pause now to bring you a word from our most delicious sponsor, Blue Apron. So I have a confession. Right now as I record this, I've got my newborn baby with me in my lap because a week ago I had a baby. And 2 weeks before that, I moved. So suffice it to say, the last month has been crazy for me. And in the middle of all of it, I still have to feed the rest of my family. I can't just say, well, we're moving, I'm having a baby, you're not getting fed. It still has to happen. And Blue Apron saved my life. As many of you know, Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the entire country. Every week to your front door, they will deliver a box that is full of fresh, beautiful, wholesome ingredients that are perfectly proportioned to make the recipes that they include in that box. And those recipes are restaurant level, gourmet quality recipes. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everybody. And they do this by supporting a more sustainable food system. And they set some of the highest standards in the industry by using the best ingredients and building a community of home chefs. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the U.S. So everything that comes to you is sourced sustainably. And because every ingredient is pre-measured, pre-proportioned, guess what? There's no food waste. But these quality ingredients don't come to you at a premium price. Blue Apron is affordable. You end up spending less than $10 per person per meal for a delicious, home-cooked, fresh meal with the best ingredients available. And the recipes rotate constantly. You're never going to find the same recipe within the same year. They are seasonal and creative, and they are always changing things up. For example, some of the featured upcoming meals from Blue Apron are salmon piccata with orzo and broccoli, vegetable chili and baked sweet potatoes with crispy tortilla strips. God, that sounds good. And spicy shrimp coconut curry with cabbage and rice. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals for free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/45. You are going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/45. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. The first thing I want to talk about is revisiting the executive order, because I talked about that at length in the first episode. So we've got Executive Order 2.0 on immigration stuff, and it is titled Protecting the Nation from Foreign Terrorist Entry into the United States. Okay, so the title itself sets up the purpose of this executive order. Iraq has been taken off the list. So there's six countries left: Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. And the 90-day ban still applies to those other countries. What's interesting is there's some exceptions. So if you're holding a visa as of January 27th of this year, then you can still come. It exempts lawful permanent residents, meaning green card holders, and as I said, current visa holders. There's no more religious exemption, which religious minorities, which in those countries would have been Christians and certainly not Muslims. They have lifted the indefinite suspension of Syrian refugees, but have a general ban on all refugees for 120 days. A couple of things the executive order has said is this. First of all, they've said that three of the countries are state sponsors of terror. Now, one of those is Syria, okay? And I want to talk about that in terms of what you mentioned earlier, right? On one hand, you're saying maybe the long-term plan here is to rid that area of like these terrorist elements so people can be resettled in their own homes. But the problem in Syria is that much of the displacement is not because of ISIS. It is Assad, it's Bashar Assad, and it's Russia assisting him. So how do you reconcile the fact that Syria, on one hand, is designated by us as a state sponsor of terror? Secondly, they're committing war crimes against their own people. They're killing many more people, exponentially more people than ISIS is in Syria, with the idea that number one, we're going to be deploying troops there. Number two, we're going to help people resettle there when Assad himself is trying to kill them and not ISIS. Like, how do you respond to that, Sarah?
I mean, when everything was blown apart, sort of like it was under Tito in Yugoslavia or Saddam in Iraq, you have these power vacuums. And these people were all kept together because it was tyrannical rule to some degree, but also it was, you know, people were kept happy. They were kept busy with their jobs to keep paying for stuff. And they had, you know, they had something they could work towards, right? So it was very simple. But the moment everything was blown apart, you have these power vacuums. And it wasn't just ISIS that came into the picture. There's like 23 different factions fighting in Syria. And it's hard to identify who's what. There's so much happening. And then you have open borders where people are coming in from different places to fight some jihad of some faction. So it's pretty chaotic. I don't know where the designation of the state-sponsored terror group is, because honestly, that pace is such a mess. Even, you know, Assad sponsoring terror too. So at this point, my biggest question would be, you know, where is Putin in this whole picture? And how come, you know, we're okay to stop people from coming there, from there, but at the same time, we're not going to put pressure on Putin or try to talk to him if he's such a buddy with us about how we're going to assist in preventing that type of immigration into this country. It just, there's a lot of contradictions, and I don't think anyone truly understands what the situation is.
I just think, again, it comes back to the fact that their, you know, statements of their policy and what their intentions are don't actually match what they're doing. And I guess in general, I feel like you're willing to give them the benefit of the doubt a lot more than I am, in terms of that they actually, even though their actions have nothing to do with their stated goals, I think you're willing to believe that they do intend to carry out their stated goals. Whereas for me, I think they're trying to do what their policies look like. And the reason that the stated goals don't match the policy is that they're lying about what they're trying to do.
Well, I have confidence in General Mattis. I think that he's a good guy. I think he knows what he's doing. I think he's sensible. He's come out with some statements that do contradict the president, and they've been pretty reasonable in what he's saying because he knows his stuff. And I think I'm relying on that more than the statements coming out of the White House most of the time.
Yeah, it's an interesting political science experiment. Like, what happens when you have some, you know, like, sane, competent, functional administrators in the state who are nominally, at least in Tim Tillerson's case, nominally, you know, have great positions of power, but an executive that's wild, erratic, and often irrational. Like, which side wins?
Well, we're going to find out. I do want to talk a little bit about the deployment, because I think, Sarah, you also might feel a little bit differently about this. But now, so they said that those three countries are, okay, state sponsors of terrorism, and that's why they're on their list. And the other countries, well, this is what they said. They refer to a 2016 Homeland Security memo, which does something interesting. It says anybody who is eligible for a visa waiver. And for folks who don't know, visa waiver program is a program like between United States and a number of other countries, mostly Western and European countries, but also Canada, that allows folks to go to those countries on your passport without actually having to apply for a visa. So the visa has been waived. You just go, you've got a U.S. passport, I can go to England, I can go to Canada with it, right? They let you in, they'll stamp it. But I don't need to apply for a visa, which is a whole process. So that's called a visa waiver program. In 2016, what DHS did was it designated a number of countries that said, if you've visited any of these countries, then you're not eligible for the waiver. So let's say you have somebody coming from the UK and they visited Yemen, okay, and it's in their passport. Well, in that case, that person, in order to enter the United States, has to apply for a visa, because what the visa process does is allows them the time to do a background check. To make sure, you know, to pass the name on to the FBI and other agencies, Interpol, make sure you haven't been involved in any kind of criminal stuff. Your name doesn't raise any red flags. And that's what they are referring to in this executive order, that because DHS already designated these countries as areas of concern where foreign fighters are going to fight, that is the justification for including them on this list, the Homeland Security justification. Now, one thing about that is, number one, it did not bar people who visited those countries from entering. Number two, that was about specifically the foreign fighter concern. People going from Western nations, which has been a phenomenon, to go and fight in those countries, not to bring the fight back home necessarily. Now, another thing that the executive order says is that since 2001, and this is this kind of like, I read this and I read it like a few times because I said, I know this is not right, because I have been working on this stuff for a while now. Since 2001, hundreds of persons born abroad have been convicted of terrorism-related crimes in the United States. Since 2001. This is completely unfactual. This is just wrong. It is inaccurate. Of the seven countries that have been initially singled out by Trump, zero have been killed in terrorist attacks on U.S. soil between not just since 2001, but since 1975 and 2015. Not to say that people haven't tried, because there's been research done by a gentleman named Alex Noroste with the Cato Institute. And he found that since 1975, only 17 people who are nationals of these countries have ever been convicted in the United States. Since 1975, 17 people, okay? And 20 out of the 3.25 million refugees we have allowed in this country in that time, only 20 have been convicted of terror charges. Only 3 were actually able to kill Americans, and those 3 were Cubans. And one of the most fascinating aspects of this is that if you look at the nationalities, and we've brought this up before, of the people who have actually succeeded in killing Americans in the homeland, the nationalities of those people that top the list are Saudi and Pakistani. And those countries are not on this list. So again and again, there's so many ways to challenge the premise that this is actually about homeland security. And it leaves people like me totally confused.
I mean, at a certain point, when someone's actions don't match at all their stated intentions, I think you have to accept as fact that their stated intentions are not what they're trying to do. But either they're like so delusional, they don't know how to do a basic government policy, or this is not about keeping out terrorists.
Well, what is it about then? That is where I am confused.
It's about keeping out the majority of the Muslim immigrants to this Muslim refugees to this country.
Look at these countries, guys. Where are they located?
In Muslim areas.
No, like what part of the world are they in?
And they're in the Middle East. They're in the Middle East.
Exactly. And not just that. What do we have down on the ground in those places?
Oil.
Not Trump Towers.
No. We have military there. We have people, well, not in Iran, but, you know, we have military, regional military interests there, and we are physically there. So, you know, I think this is closely tied to the military operations that we plan to carry out in the next 3 to 6 months. Honestly, I don't think this has to do with the Muslim ban per se. That's what I've been saying.
Whoa. Are you saying that you think that we're going to be doing actions there that's going to cause people to be terrorists? We have to keep them out now?
No. I'm saying that right now, as we speak, we are having offensives where we're supporting local Iraqi forces in Mosul and parts of Syria as we speak right now. It's just not popping out there in the news all the time because the operations are happening. So I think this is closely tied to making sure, like I said before, that these countries that are not able to vet people that well because they could slip through the system are just going to go through some vigorous screening. I know I'm making it sound very nonchalant, but I just feel like they're trying to correlate the military operations and whatever they're planning to do with ISIS and that whole geopolitical goals out there in that part of the world with immigration at this point. It is just that's why it's a temporary ban.
I don't see the correlation though, because we're guessing that in the future those countries will be more dangerous than they have been in the past, because there's no historical danger. So it must be a prospective danger worth talking about.
No, I just think it's part of the military way of handling things right now. It's part of the military strategy. It's making sure that nothing happens on U.S. soil while we're doing these things. And I think it might be a little exaggerated, but I think there also might be, with all due respect to General Mattis and the other experts in this, there might be a reason why they're saying this. And I'm not sure what their opinion is on the ban itself. I don't think they probably have one. I just think that they know that they have to carry out this mission. And, you know, they let the president do what he has to do on a domestic scale. I just think the rhetoric, the lack of perspective, and the way it's made out to look like immigrants are like pouring in and doing all this bad stuff. I mean, and stealing jobs is just too much.
I think, the only thing that makes sense to me about like designating these countries is like, you know, you have the highest conflict in these countries, right? The most longstanding conflict. You have the most activity by terrorist organizations in these countries. It's not to say that terrorists are not operating in Pakistan. Now, they are. ISIS is in Pakistan. ISIS is in Afghanistan, which also didn't make the list. But I get maybe that they are somehow connecting that this high, all this continuous, really intense conflict maybe is radicalizing people. Maybe that they are going to be doing. And, you know, there's been kind of an evolution of how violent extremists and terrorists have operated over the last 10, 15 years, which is like it used to be like, I mean, starting with, you know, 9/11, is that you send people from outside into the country to attack, right? Then we got much better with our vetting, with our security procedures, and we were able to shut that down largely. And it's morphed. Then it became about financing, right? And so, and then we shut a lot of that down. A lot of organizations in the United States were shut down for sending money overseas that got funneled to these groups. Then it became about just inspiring people online. And that's kind of where we are now. So I don't know necessarily that many terror experts would agree that because there's high, you know, there's a lot of activity there by terror groups, that if we shut the visa process, it's not going to, it's going to make us any safer. Because I think
Robbie, online
is still going to happen.
Do you think military operations happen in isolation and that there's no collateral things you have to think about? I think this is the collateral. Basically, when you're going on ground offensives, people are going to start hating you and they're going to start more anti-American sentiments. So in some ways, you know, making sure that nothing happens coming out of those countries where the offensives and the military operations are happening is one way of ensuring that we don't have something happen on the homeland.
So like one problem I have, a huge problem I have with that is that it means that blatantly the stated reasons and the public justifications for this bill are untrue. If they're actually planning this bill because they plan to have military offensives in this country and think that that will cause additional risk of, I don't know, of more terrorist immigrants, then they need to say that. Right now, they're not saying that. So I would have a huge problem with them making false justifications for the purpose of a bill in order to get
passed. He told us very clearly that when he does stuff, he's not going to let the enemy know.
But that's not, doesn't mean it's okay for him to do that. Like in a democracy, these kind of things, you can't lie to the public to pass a bill and then say it's because it's my strategy.
But they've announced redeployment of Afghanistan. They've announced the deployment of I don't know how many thousands of troops to Syria now. So it's not like the enemy doesn't know. I mean, some of this, you know.
Oh, yeah, they know.
No, there are troops coming. It would make more sense to me, too. I would say, okay, let me think about that then. I mean,
there's at least a connection. There's a factual connection between the stated problem and the stated goal.
And then the enemy would be like, oh, so he's saying this. Oh, it must be because of this. So, you know what? They're just not going to tell us the whole story. And that's just the way it's always been.
You know what I also think?
We can't have a system that's based on the fact that we can never know the true motives of our leaders.
Not motives. It's just the strategy is never known to everyone.
I have another theory, though. I'll tell you what my theory is. My theory is, as we pointed out earlier, these are all countries that are in the Middle East, North Africa. And I really think the administration doesn't realize that the majority of Muslims actually don't live there. They live in Indonesia and they live in the Indian subcontinent. And I think, wasn't there a recent administration official, I don't know if it was Bannon or who made the mistake of saying, yeah, most Muslims, you know, globally come from the Middle East. They don't.
But 20% come from the Middle East. 20%.
In terms of refugees, though, those countries do make up the vast majority of our Muslim refugees.
They do. But I do wonder if they're like, oh, we had no idea that there's actually more Muslims living in Indonesia. Are they be on the list too?
Oh, but Trump has towers are going up in Indonesia. So that's not going to happen.
Okay.
Well, I've been saying this for a while as a conflict resolution practitioner. Most of the refugees are coming from the Middle East because that's where the conflicts are right now. It's not a Muslim thing. It's maybe an Arab thing, but it's not a Muslim thing, because what about the 80% of Muslims that don't live in the Middle East?
I wanted to talk about another provision in this, which I thought was really odd, actually. There is a reporting provision that the executive order makes, basically says that the Secretary of Homeland Security shall collect and make publicly available the following information. Number one, information regarding the number of foreign nationals in the U.S. who have been charged with terrorism-related offenses. Number two, information regarding the number of foreign nationals in the U.S. who have been radicalized after entry and who have engaged in terror-related acts. Number three, and this was like, made me stop in my tracks, information regarding the number and types of acts of gender-based violence against women, including so-called honor killings in the U.S. by foreign nationals. Okay. So anytime there's a need to collect this kind of data, you know, it does make you concerned about how that data is collected, who is doing the collecting, what does that process look like, and then making it publicly available. The fourth provision says charged with major offenses, not convicted of, but charged, okay? So presumably innocent until proven guilty, but charged, what that's going to do to their privacy. And then going back to this honor killing and gender-based violence thing, what do you guys think about that? I am a little bit alarmed by that provision in particular?
To me, what all of this says is that Trump doesn't have the stats he wants to support his policies, so he's going to make sure they exist, whatever it takes to get them.
Okay, well, I'm thinking that honor killings do happen in this country. Apparently, there's a report that says there's 23 to 27 of them happening per year in the U.S., in North America. And I can see that could be an issue. I just don't understand why it would be put into a paper like that that's looking at the community as a whole. It's kind of stigmatizing. But at the same time, it's about perspective. I mean, do we look at other types of killings that happen with drunk driving and other stuff in the country? We have like a 600% rise in heroin usage in the state of Virginia, and it now outdoes driving car accidents as the number one killer in the state of Virginia. Are we looking at stuff like that? I mean, why is this little piece? It just goes back to this whole thing of doing an ideological test.
Gun violence. Hello, gun violence.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going back to Trump's whole thing of let's do an ideological test because people have to prove that they love this country for its values and things, which I agree to some degree. I mean, I feel like I need to. I am an American. I espouse American values. I left my culture behind when I became an American. But at the same time, I maintain my religious beliefs. But none of my religious beliefs tell me to engage in honor killings. That's a myth. That's a cultural practice. And so I get what he's saying, but it's not something that he should be putting out there because, again, it's alarmist and it puts things out of perspective.
Well, he wants that perspective to be skewed because, again, with the reports he was getting, so he asked for the agencies to create reports that would support his new immigration or new travel ban. And the numbers he got back didn't help his case.
Well, here's the thing, though. First of all, I see no nexus between this, specifically this provision, and the stated purpose of the executive order, which is to stop terrorism in this country. Like, what is the connection there? So for me, it is just by asking for such a report, he is perpetuating a stereotype that has long existed in like anti-Muslim, Islamophobic kind of activist circles about gender violence in the Muslim community, as if there is something different about it than it. I mean, you mentioned American values, Sarah. Well, you know, every 30 seconds, a woman in this country is attacked by a partner or spouse. And one in four women who go to university here will be raped. I mean, how do we decide what is a Muslim value, an American value? I mean, like, how do you do that? Like,
because there is an ongoing perception that this is an ideological factor. It's actually taught within the ideology of the religion, which is completely false. And if it is, it's not Islamic. This is what women, Muslim women like myself and yourself, stand up against, is the cultural manifestations of Islam, where patriarchal societies impose their own views of, you know, misogyny. And we're trying to fight that ourselves. But this doesn't help. It doesn't help.
Look, people who abuse, men who abuse women and are violent against women, no matter where they come from, they have their justifications. There's from, you made me do it, right? You made me do it, which is very commonly heard. And I've represented many women who have been victims of domestic violence. I have been a victim of domestic violence. And so the idea that you made me do it is not uncommon. So the justification will exist across cultures, right? But yeah, it's true that in some Muslim families or whatever Muslim societies, that they will say, you know what, I'm justified because, you know, the Quran said I could do it. And in other places, people will say, well, the Bible said I can do it. And men will, like, I've always felt that there is no culture or society or nationality that has a monopoly on this issue. Women suffer violence in every culture and society, and then the perpetrators find justifications for it. But when you have the President of the United States framing it like this, what he's doing is pathologizing one group and saying that this is specifically, like, this is inherent to this group for whatever reason. And we know honor killings are almost always attached and understood to be a phenomena that comes like out of Muslim countries and Middle Eastern countries, which is not true. It actually happens in many different societies. And for folks who actually don't know, specifically what an honor killing refers to is when the family of a woman, meaning her brother, her father, her uncle, her own family, maybe even sometimes her own mother, hurts her or kills her because she has somehow hurt the family honor. So she's actually killed by members of her own family. And this is a phenomenon that is found, even, for example, if you're talking about the Middle East, it's found among people who are not Muslim in the Middle East, by Christians in the Middle East. It's found in Sikh and Hindu communities in the subcontinent. It's even found in Korean cultures. I mean, like, I've done research on this. But then the reaction to this provision from organizations and institutions and activists who work on these issues has been a tremendous pushback. And they're very alarmed because they think what's going to happen now is that this will decrease reporting, right? So if you have a woman who suffered this, she's going to be less inclined to actually report the abuse because this data will not be collected, because it could impact her family in a way where if her husband or spouse is deported or for some reason, you know, like he could be a breadwinner or just whatever reason. Or even, I know women who don't want to talk about these issues because they feel like it further demonizes their own community. So domestic violence activists in the Muslim community are like, it's so hard to get our own communities to talk about this because they're like, we're just reinforcing these horrible stereotypes and demonizing our own community further. And it makes their work really hard.
And I think it goes back to the purpose of the bill. I mean, why include that here? There's no connection between there's no connection between we're planning to have more military offensives in these six countries, so we can't have people coming from there, and let's make sure we can easily have statistics to make Muslims look bad.
But Susan, they're trying to make the connection through this. And the way they're doing it is, if terrorism happens by a non-Muslim, it's an anomaly. It's not part of the cultural norm. Whereas if it happens with a Muslim, it's part of the cultural norm. Same way, an honor killing happens, it's part of the cultural norm of those people. Whereas if it happens over here, like, you know, a woman gets raped or killed here, it's out of the norm. It's not part of a cultural system. So that's what it's trying to get at. It's part of that stigma, and I think it's unfair because, again, I've been yelling this again, there's no perspective in this. It's just putting stuff out there for an agenda.
But doesn't what you just said cut against the idea this is not about banning Muslims?
I don't think the ban has any relation to direct relation to the fact that the maligning of Muslims has been happening anyway. I think the ban, literally, I honestly believe it has to do with the military strategy.
But why put it in this bill? Why?
That I agree with you. I'm like, why is that hanging there?
I mean, it could just be like a Stephen Miller bloop, you're right. I mean, it could just be like a stupidity, and they were like, we're just going to throw everything else in here. But there's really no nexus. You know, look, I will say this, though, and I'll say this because as somebody who's worked for the last 5-6 years on these issues, there are some people who say that there is a nexus between not just terrorism and domestic violence, but also gun violence and mass shootings. The Sandy Hook shootings and other examples in which oftentimes people who commit mass violence have already hurt or even killed some women. They'll start at home. They'll kill their mother, they kill their sister, kill their wives, and then they'll move on and commit mass violence in society. And so there are people who have made the argument that one way, a factor in determining whether somebody's been radicalized is whether they abuse women. But I think it's a bit of a stretch, and there really isn't data to support it, but, you know, let's see how that plays out. I don't know, and I think it's going to be, it's going to end up being kind of harmful to the victims of domestic violence who are going to be scared to report it.
Another topic that I'm interested in, and has kind of been strangely underreported on the news, or at least hasn't really gotten the kind of traction I'd expect, is a man named Felix Sater. He is a long-term business partner of Donald Trump's. They have worked together on a lot of projects over the years. And recently it came into the news again when it came out that he was part of this Ukrainian peace plan plot that involved Sater and Michael Cohen, a Trump Organization lawyer, who worked with this Ukrainian politician to transmit a quote-unquote peace plan for Crimea to Trump through, well, the now dismissed Flynn. And the peace plan seems to have involved, in part, giving Trump blackmail material against the Ukrainian president so that he could help force the deal through. But the fact that Sater was involved at all is fascinating, because why would Sater pop up now in this role? I think in part because he never actually really left. He's been connected to Trump so long that I don't think their connection's ever really been severed. But Sater's role in Trump's life goes back to around 2001, 2002. He's a convicted felon with a long history of securities fraud and organized crime with the Russian mafia. And if you asked Felix Sater who he was, he would tell you that he's like America's secret unsung hero. And it's the result of his work as a covert agent overseas, working in conjunction with America's three-letter agencies. And through that work, he is single-handedly responsible for saving hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of American lives. And all of this has been reported on, but like I said, it's never really gotten any kind of like mainstream attention. And most people seem to have no idea who Sater is, which I find odd because just like take away the Trump angle and his story is so fascinating that you think that alone would be a hook. And you add Trump in, and I mean, I would expect this to be like a huge deal during the campaign, and it never really was. As for Sater's history, this is what his attorney said at his sentencing hearing for his racketeering conviction in 2009. Felix Sater was really a self-made man, as you know from the pre-sentence report and letters. He was an immigrant from Russia. He worked his way to Wall Street, where he was very successful. He was a young man who was working at several at the time name brand brokerage firms, including Shearson and Lemon, until one unfortunate night in 1991, at age 25, he went to a bar, had too much to drink, and got into an altercation with another person. The other person suffered. Mr. Sater hit that other person, and that impulsive act resulted in a criminal conviction for Mr. Sater. That had a cascade of consequences for him. He lost his Series 7 brokerage license. As a convicted felon, he was not really able to get legitimate work. He was in need of money. He was married and had a young child. He foolishly connected with some friends from his boyhood who were operating a securities brokerage firm. Now, those boyhood friends at the securities brokerage were actually members of the Russian mob who were involved in organized fraud on Wall Street. And that time he hit someone in the face was actually when he got a martini glass and stabbed the guy in the face. But after this happened, after Sater was convicted and could no longer be a regular securities broker, he joined these companies, they're called White Rock and State Street, where they committed like pump and dump securities fraud schemes on a pretty large scale. And according to his cooperation agreement, he defrauded investors of $60 million. In the late 90s, the feds caught on to the scheme. Sater was brought in. The whole sequence of those events is a bit fuzzy, but up until 1998, we know Sater was working in Russia, and the official story is that he was working for AT&T in Moscow until he learned the FBI was looking for him, so he came back home. And now for a variety of reasons, I don't think that's the whole story probably, and for some reason that part of Sater's life is redacted in all the filings, so still not sure what's going on there.
What did he do for AT&T?
Redacted.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when you say that the FBI was looking for him, so he comes back, he's coming back because he's turning himself in for something? Or do we know what that means exactly?
I think there's more to the story there. This is purely a guess, but we know that later on he was working the CIA to kind of purchase Russian like radar systems. And I wonder if there's some kind of overlap there with his time as a, quote, in a telecom in Russia. The whole sequence is very fuzzy and doesn't really match up, which is why I think, combined with the redaction, something more is going on then. But either way, he ends up being charged for these securities frauds in 1998. He pleads guilty. And the caption for the case is like U.S. versus Felix Sater, a.k.a. Paul Stewart. And I still don't know what that alias is from. So he pled guilty to one count of racketeering, faced up to 20 years in prison, and agreed to act as an informant. Now, that cooperation agreement does talk about some of his other crimes during this time period. For instance, in one paragraph, it stipulates that Sater will not be charged for additional crimes he's admitted to the FBI as of that date involving fraudulent securities transactions from approximately February 93 through October 98, false tax reporting and filings for the years 93 through 97, threats of violence in connection with securities transactions from approximately October 93 through September 96, and unlawful possession of firearms from approximately March 96 through January 98.
Threats of violence.
Oh, yeah. And again, why is he being charged with unlawful gun possession at a time he's supposed to be working for AT&T in Moscow? So, yeah, Sater has admitted to money laundering, tax fraud, threats of violence in connection with securities transactions and unlawful gun possession, which are all pretty serious crimes. And within 3 or 4 years of this, if not less, while still on sentence for the crime he did plead guilty to, he would be working out of Trump's tower and have increasing importance as Trump's business partner. Basically, as a convicted felon, he couldn't be the business guy he was being. So he started operating under the name Satter with two T's, S-A-T-T-E-R, and kind of hid his ownership in this company called Bayrock that he operated with another Russian mobster, Tevik Arif. And the two of them became Trump's new favorite business partners. And they had towers they were trying to build in like Fort Lauderdale and Phoenix and Denver and Moscow and Kiev and Yalta and Turkey, New York, Trump Soho. So yeah, during this like next 8 year period from 2001 to 2008 or nine, Trump and Bayrock are like doing business all over the place. Their towers usually fail. The ones that do go up end up in litigation for like fraud and like securities failures and all kinds of things. And during this whole time, Satter is his, you know, his history is not disclosed to investors or banks. And as he stated at his sentencing hearing, this is because he knew if it was disclosed, the banks wouldn't lend money to him. And they had over like $1 billion lent to them during this time period.
A billion? Did you say B with a B?
Over a billion, yeah.
Okay.
It was major money. And again, during this whole time period, Satter is he's pled guilty to a crime, is facing up to 20 years in prison, but is unsentenced. And an active informant and cooperator with the government. As for what he was doing, that's where the story gets interesting. Because, I mean, the first case that Satter, that we know of, cooperated on was a relatively standard, but still significant. And as a result of his cooperation there, the New York U.S. Attorney's Office was able to indict, quote, 19 defendants, including 6 members and associates of various organized crime families of La Cosa Nostra, who are charged with participating in a large-scale stock fraud and money laundering scheme between 1993 and 1996. But this was these indictments happened in like March of 2000, and his work as an informant would continue until 2009. And what he was doing is apparently a very closely guarded state secret. Well, closely guarded by everyone but Satter himself at times. And here's from a later court filing. For over 11 years, John Doe, a.k.a. Felix Satter, provided extraordinary cooperation to multiple United States law enforcement and national security agencies in connection with dozens of cases involving organized crime, securities fraud, and redacted.
Wow.
Because of the significance and extreme sensitivity surrounding some of these investigations, including matters of national security, the court sealed Mr. Doe's entire criminal file. And
Susan, question. Yeah. So when you say he's a close business partner of Donald Trump's, is this like he's got his own, what was the name of his company?
Bayrock.
So Bayrock has what, maybe 100 employees. And so he's running that alongside with Trump's organization that has its own workforce. I mean, are these like close friends or are they just business friends?
Bayrock has about 5 employees at any given time. And Trump is traveling the world with them. And they can just walk into his office and say hi. They're very close. Like most of Trump's ventures during this time period were with Bayrock.
What's interesting to me so far is that on one hand, Trump has, I mean, he's so close to this person. It almost seems like a personal relationship. It probably is. And this person is then working for the same agencies that Trump is now, you know, calling into question in terms of their legitimacy. And I'm just trying to figure out how to square this circle.
A lot of people are, because there's a lot that makes sense here.
But I don't think that's necessarily, needs to be correlated, the fact that this guy, Satter, worked for those agencies. And now, as president, he's trying to skim where he feels he needs to skim. I don't think that's necessarily related, though.
But, okay, so if Satter was an important guy from the government's perspective. As was noted in a 2001 filing from the Office of the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, in a Second Circuit appeal, Felix Sater's cooperation was of an extraordinary depth and breadth, almost unseen, at least in this United States Attorney's office. And in his sentencing in 2009, his attorney noted, "We understand that to ask for a sentence of no jail term and no probation is extraordinary, but we think it is warranted in this case where Mr. Satter really has been under sort of de facto probation for the last 10 years. As he has worked very closely with the FBI agents, the government has not seen it necessary to impose any kind of restrictions or conditions on Mr. Satter over the last 10 years. He has been traveling freely and does travel to Russia in connection with the real estate business he's involved in, and the government has not imposed any reporting requirement on him over those last 10 years. Now that's his attorney. Here's what the AUSA said, is that Mr. Satter was really the FBI's entry into the types of financial frauds that were being perpetrated. At the time, in the mid to late 90s, the criminal financial wizards were one step ahead of law enforcement. And literally, that was until Felix Satter cooperated with the FBI. And then there are instances far too numerous to mention in a 5K letter, but they would take my given, but they would take any given investigation that they were looking into at the time, bring it in front of Felix Sater, and he would explain to them what was going on. He clearly illuminated and elicited information to them, which brought countless arrests and halted the fraud at the time. That would be enough, Your Honor, for us to stand here and tell you that Felix Sater went above and beyond, but that was only the beginning. And then the next page is all redacted. So, official record can't tell us what's going on, but...
Oh my gosh, I really want to know what's on that page.
Another AUSA said, I did want to underline two things. One was Mr. Sater's cooperation to this office and the many investigations he participated in. The length of his cooperation is extraordinary, and I wanted to be here to express from the office's perspective just how capable a cooperator he was, how important a cooperator he was, and how effective he was. Next page is redacted.
Hmm.
Now,
where is this dude now?
Oh, he's still doing his real estate businesses and his like cancer curing scheme company. But so here's the story. I mean, officially it's all redacted, but we know what he was doing. He was overseas. Part of the time he was trying to buy Stinger missiles from Al-Qaeda. Part of the time he was claiming he could provide super secret intel on Osama bin Laden. He claims that he's the reason that Bush had Osama bin Laden's phone number. Here's a clip I'll play of an award he won at his synagogue. Here is his rabbi speaking about him and what he had to say about Felix's past.
You think you know Felix Sater? Let me tell you something you don't know. I have been Felix's friend and rabbi for 16 years. In the early years of our friendship, he would come and talk to me. He would tell me stories, and he would say that he needed someone to tell these things to. He would tell me about things he's done and he was involved in. I tell you, friends, these stories were strange and getting stranger with each passing month. Rabbi, you know what I did last week? I did this. And oh my God, you know where I was last week in such and such a place? And I'm thinking, sure, of course you did that. Do I really look like the type who's out there shopping for a bridge? I only recently told Felix I really didn't believe most of it. I thought perhaps he watched too many James Bond movies, read one too many Tom Clancy novels. Anyone who knows Felix knows that he can tell a good story. I simply did not put much credence to them. One fine day, 2.5 years ago, Felix invited me to join him at a private closed-door session in the federal building in New York. Only his immediate family members were allowed in, and he'd gotten special clearance for his rabbi to be there as well. I get there, and to my amazement, I see dozens of U.S. intelligence officers from all of the various three-letter intelligence agencies of this country, including some I had never even known existed. They're taking turns standing up one after the other, offering praise for Felix, praising him as an American hero for his work and his assistance in the highest levels of this country's national security interests. They were speaking about Felix Sater, my Felix. They're talking about his clandestine activities to help the government and protect our country. They elaborated in great detail, stuff that was more fantastic and more unbelievable than anything he had been telling me. I vividly recall one of the officers proudly stating, and I quote, "Felix Sater probably saved tens of thousands of U.S. lives, maybe even millions. He certainly saved the lives of thousands, if not of hundreds, if not thousands of U.S. servicemen and women through the brave work that he's done, battling at the risk of his own life with this country's greatest enemies." Friends, I sat there open-mouthed. I was flabbergasted. Here I was listening to these stories for the past decade. To me, they were all Bubba Mises, Felix Mises. And here I am hearing them being said by federal agents about my Felix Sater. He wasn't just bragging. The stories I didn't believe. And I realized that he only told me 1/10 of what really went on.
Okay, so there's two things here. All this could be bullshit or it could be real. I mean, this obviously the U.S. government has taken a position that it's all national security secrets and must be redacted. At the same time, Felix Sater is kind of like a perennial con artist who has very successfully wheeled and dealed his way throughout all kinds of business deals. And it would not shock me if he also did that to an extent with his acts of being an informant and cooperating with the government. Because
it completely sounds like the kind of person who would just make up stuff and feed it to intelligence agencies. I could be wrong.
But the U.S. government keeps saying that, like,
he's very valuable. Yeah.
So obviously what he was doing, we know he was working over in the Middle East and in Russia. I think there was, you know, the certain Russian technologies he was trying to get. But he was working with the Russian mob this whole time and using their contacts with, like, terrorists in the Middle East to give the government intel on terrorists in the Middle East, too. Which is why it's the whole national security angle. And you know what? We have no idea how inflated this is or not.
Have we ever had a president that had shady people around him?
And Sater's not the most shady of them. I'm just talking about him today, but, like, it gets worse than that. Here's what Sater told the Russian media, since it's Google Translate. But when he was asked about how his work began, he said, I can't tell you all the details, but I'll tell you that I started out with a hunt for bin Laden in 98. Do you remember when Clinton, you know, had those missile attacks on bin Laden's bases by tracing a satellite phone? This data was brought to the government by me. But since September 11, my work's increased tenfold. I was in the most frustrating parts of the world with the most dangerous people because I'm an American citizen and considered myself a patriot of this country.
Okay.
It's a lot to handle, especially with a real estate company.
Yes, and that's where it gets even weirder because, again, Sater was only working because he was Felix Sater. This, like, hid the fact he was a convicted criminal, not just the, you know, the assault, but also securities fraud. And during this time period, you know, at least three different business partners have gone on the record and under oath said that he threatened them physically with, like, dismembering, maiming, killing their family.
Jesus Christ.
As a result of business disputes.
Hey, Susan, I have a question. You know how, like, on the campaign trail, there were always issues coming up about whether or not the president was a successful businessman, and then you'd have, you know, debate over that issue. So tell me what these buildings that Sater and, you know, the Trump organization was going around making. I mean, what makes these buildings fall through eventually? What is it that's going wrong each place?
There are a lot of theories. One could just be that they're bad businessmen. Another is that, for instance, Trump Soho, which, you know, went bankrupt, had a lot of issues. Very kind of peculiar project that involved, like, condo hotels where you buy a condo and you can stay there for, like, I think up to 120 days of the year, and the rest of the time it's a hotel room. Weird project. And also it strangely has money from, like, sources that are look like money laundering. And then Fort Lauderdale, you have a project that kind of failed as a project. And also Sater's involvement in his criminal history was disguised from investors who were not happy about that. So from the 2001 or 2 to 2008 time period, when Sater is in Trump Tower and regularly, like, walking into Trump's room to talk to him, he is an active informant. For instance, in 2003, a letter was given to the court. It was saying, unlimited international travel is hereby requested for Felix Sater, the defendant in the above referenced case. The travel is being requested by the FBI. And 2005, currently Mr. Sater is working with the FBI involving a new long-term investigation of significant national importance. The same time that, you know, Sater's in Moscow looking for Trump Tower Moscow for Trump. So the government clearly cares a lot about this guy. They're keeping an eye on him. And they're not saying a word when a convicted felon hiding his criminal past with a fake name is entering into millions, hundreds of million dollar deals without disclosing his role or involvement. And these deals are themselves inherently shady. And they also know this guy is, like, an expert at financial fraud to the point where he's the one who told the FBI, hey, this is what the fraud is and what it looks like. Like, he is their go-to expert on large-scale complicated financial fraud. So they know all these facts. And they're sitting here watching him enter into at least 5 or 6 deals with Trump. And no one says anything.
And now, if the business dealings of the president are separated from, you know, from him, and his kids are taking care of this, where does this all go?
I mean, it's not clear to say what's going on with Sater because Trump always lies about it. His decade of deals with Trump that were in the open, like, there's been litigation about just about every one. I think most of them failed, and, well, they failed at their stated goals. But take this example. In 2007, in September, Trump is photographed at the Trump Soho grand opening, like, on stage with Felix Sater and, you know, Tevika Reef, and they're all smiling and they're all side by side. 3 months later, in December of 2007, Trump is deposed in a court case he brought against this journalist who said that his total actual value was only $250 million. So Trump sues for defamation, and he's asked about Sater. And he's like, Sater? Sater who? And he says outright, if Sater was in a room with me, I don't think I'd know who he was. This is a blatant lie, as can be shown for a lot of reasons. Point is, Trump knew Sater. They traveled together. They did business together. They were seen talking to like other businesses, like partners and other towers and projects together. When Trump's kids were in Russia, Trump personally asked Sater to go and escort them because he was so familiar with Russia and he wanted them to keep his kids safe. This is the guy, he says, under oath, I don't know who that is. I think he's in Bayrock, maybe, something. And of course, Sater, when he testifies, is like, yeah, I mean, I was the floor below Trump. I was always up talking to him. We talked alone. We talked business plans. We dealt with like Bayrock stuff. We had our own business discussions. So also what happened in 2007 is that Sater's history was exposed publicly. So he had to like pretend to leave Bayrock and, you know, deal with a lot of financial fallout from that. But even after this, in 2010, he joins the Trump Organization as a senior advisor to Trump. A guy that Trump knows is not only like has a history of securities fraud, but had to like leave his own business when that was publicly disclosed. Trump's now making him senior advisor in the Trump Organization.
This reminds me of a briefing in the past week that Sean Spicer gave, in which he talked about how high the ethics of the president are. That, in terms of, and it was, he was actually talking in reference to Flynn's recent disclosure on being a foreign agent and his foreign lobbying. And he said, well, you know, if the president knew about these things, his standards for the people he works with are really, really high ethical standards. And so this is kind of breathtaking.
That's what he said in 07 when he was like asked about the recently disclosed history of Sater. He's like, well, how, I didn't know that. I mean, now that I know, I'm obviously not going to do business with him. And then like in 2012, when he's confronted by the fact he's still doing business with him, he says under oath again, I didn't know he had a criminal history for fraud. Even though he's previously gone under oath in another deposition talking about his knowledge of Sater's history of fraud.
Really bad memory, Alzheimer's, I don't know.
Well, here's how he reacted. Trump reacted in a 2013 interview with the BBC when someone asked him about why Felix Sater was still such an integral part of Trump Organization.
Why didn't you go to Felix Sater and say, you're connected with the mafia, you're fired?
Well, first of all, we were not the developer there. That was a licensing deal.
Much but your about name's Felix. On it, Mr. Trump.
Excuse me, but I don't know. You're telling me things that I don't even know about. I mean, you're telling me about Felix Sater. I know who he is.
But for a year, you stayed in bed with Felix Sater, and he was connected with the mafia.
Again, John, maybe you're thick, but when you have a signed contract, you can't, in this country, just break it. And by the way, John, I hate to do this, but I do have that big group of people waiting, so I have to
Okay, now hold on. One last question, please, sir.
I have to leave. Thank you.
And yeah, in case you can't tell from the audio, that's like literally Trump like getting up when he's questioned about Sater and like shuffling out at a moderately fast pace to avoid the interview.
So where is Sater today vis-a-vis Trump?
Well, we don't know. They obviously kept their distance during the campaign. Sater kept trying to deflect and be like, I'm not connected to Trump still, and it's terrible how the media is using my history as an American hero to try and like slander Trump. Trump's going back to saying, I don't know, Sater? Who's Sater? But again, if that's the case, why is Felix Sater suddenly popping up to transmit blackmail against the Ukrainian president to Trump that he can use to force a peace deal in Crimea?
Like, I am less surprised that somebody like Felix Sater is like, you know, buddies with Donald Trump and has been working with him. I am more surprised that, given his clear criminal history, he's been given so much protection and cover by our intelligence agencies, which means he has to be a very valuable asset, an intel asset. And I just wonder how both of these things are happening at the same time.
He's valuable enough, apparently, where the U.S. government was willing to look away from billion-dollar financial fraud.
I'm wondering if it influenced our desire to make friends with Russia now.
The thing is, we can't know what's going on because all of this is either kept redacted for security reasons, apparently, or it's Trump denying he knows who Sater is. But it seems like a pretty big deal when you have a major business partner of the now president who is acting undercover with Russian government, with the Russian government, with like other governments. I mean, this guy is connected. I do think that he is grossly overinflating his actual role everywhere. But he is connected. He does know people with very serious criminal ties, and he is trusted to make $100 million deals with them, with the U.S. government's blessing.
Bigger question, you know, the first public appearance of the president had was to clearly delineate between his presidency and his businesses and separate and kind of he's going to give it to his kids. Like, where is that now is my question with Sater.
We can't know. I mean, Sater is still at Bayrock. He now back at Bayrock, even though he allegedly left it in 2008. We just don't know. Like, Sater was the deal maker for a long time for the Trump Organization. And we know he's still talking to the Trump Organization's lawyer, Michael Cohen. So it's entirely possible Sater is still doing deals for the Trump Organization.
Wow. That is crazy, by the way, Susan.
He's born in 1966. He's 51. He's not even like, you know, wow.
Yeah. And obviously, again, they redacted the court filings and whatnot, but there's not really a question of that at least the government thought he was doing like anti-terrorist work overseas. Again,
but you know, the government has been duped before. The government has been duped before. This guy sounds like a triple agent, first of all.
At times, I've really wondered if all this comes down to the fact that they trusted this dude to do like these super covert national security missions. And all the time, like Sater was really like goofing off to Russia, where he's like, I'm going to make a new hotel deal. Right. And now the government's so embarrassed they got fooled. They're trying to cover it up and be like, dude, he was the best. That's why we let him do fraud for so long, because like he was just the best agent imaginable.
I honestly can see that happening. It would be, I mean, he sounds like such a con too, that he can get away with things like this. Interesting. All right, well, so that's it for our second episode of the 45th. We hope you guys tune in a couple of weeks, and we're going to do our best to come to you weekly very soon as well. Thanks for listening. A big shout out and thank you to everybody who makes the 45th possible. To start with, thank you, executive producer Mito Delhan. Thanks to our sponsors for supporting us. Our audio production is by Ray Gaines, and we've been produced by Long Arc Digital Media. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at The 45th Pod, and check out our website at www.45thpod.com. Subscribe, rate, and review. Thank you so much for listening. See you soon.